Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spiders. So as you've probably deduced by the title, today we're going to be talking about Theraphosa species. Now, I covered this one a while back. I think it was just about 4 years ago. And at that time, I had kept Theraphosa sturmi before. I had kept Theraphosa blondii. I had two of them that was growing up. They were getting quite big. And I had just gotten in Theraphosa apophysis or apophysis, which I was super excited to share about. But again, with my care stuff, I like to do care videos after I've had them for a while. So I always felt like that particular genus review or spotlight was a little incomplete because I had no experience with the apophysis yet. I was kind of just talking about how I had them set up as slings, and that was about it. So I'd always planned to revisit this one. The other thing is I'm planning a video, a genus review on Theraphosa, because now I have the all three species are now adults or young adults, so I can show them off and show people what they look like when they're grown up, which I'm super excited about. So I'm going to basically do rehousings of my female T. sturmi. I have a T. apophysis, the other one that I've been waiting for it to molt to put it into a new enclosure, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then I have my other T. blondii that I've been waiting. I've had an enclosure set up for it. I'm waiting for her to molt. And last time she molted, she was about 9 inches, so this one should be the big one. She's going to be a big, big girl. She's going to be getting a new enclosure as well. So we're going to do them all at the same time so we can kind of show them off, show what I'm putting them into, talk about the care, and, you know, give folks something they can lean back on when they, if they are looking at any of those species, because I personally love Theraphosa species. I know, and I go through this every time I do a video or a podcast on Theraphosa, there are folks out there that they go by the old, well, they're just big brown spiders. And I always feel I have to address this because I think those of us who love them find, well, A, I don't care if spiders are big and brown. I know that's kind of the standard thing people think of when they think of tarantula. It's just the big brown spider, and there's all these different colors out there, but I have nothing against those with earthy tones, especially ones that can get that big. For me, it was always the awe factor. I've shared the story before that when I got my first Theraphosa species, it was a Theraphosa sturmi years ago. It was at the time about a 7-inch spider, and at that time when I opened up that enclosure, that was the largest spider I had ever seen in my life. It blew my mind, and I that sense of awe, I miss that sometimes, because now I've spent years working with spiders. I love them. I adore them, but I almost miss the thrill of being like, oh, that's a giant spider. It's a giant spider. I work with them daily. But the Theraphosa species still kind of keep me in awe at their size, and I think they're beautiful. They do go through some color changes. Apophysis, I put up some videos with an orangey pink coloration to them. So not just completely brown, as people like to say. Gorgeous spiders nonetheless, and even if they are brown, who cares? So I think there's going to be those folks that just aren't interested in them, and that's fine. That's why the hobby's so great, because there are so many shapes, sizes, growth rates, colors, patterns, all that stuff out there. To each his or her own. I completely understand it, but it drives me nuts because I'll do one of these videos or I'll do a podcast and people have to go out of their way to go, yeah, I don't like them, they're big and brown. Well, go comment somewhere else. I don't care. Obviously, I do. You're not going to change my mind with that. So what's the point? So that's why I put it out there. For those of us who keep them and love them, there's just something about these giant, fairly long-lived, fast-growing spiders. So I love them. I want to share my love for them. It's one of those species, you know, I'm always going to have them in my collection. People ask me which my favorite is, and I struggle with that. I have a place in my heart for the T. sturmi because that was the first Theraphosa species I ever kept. And again, I grew up two of them, a male and a female, that I was just in awe of. But I absolutely, my two female T. blondies, these big, beefy, beautiful girls, are stunning as well. And the apophysis or apophysis, gorgeous, gorgeous spider. So I don't know. I love them all, which is why I will always hopefully have one of each in my collection for a while. The apophysis and the blondii. Blondii for a while was very difficult to get. And then we started seeing more and more of them in the hobby. The prices started to come down, which is great. And then for a while, the apophysis was on the top of my wish list. We're talking number one for a couple of years. Finally, we got some in the U.S. and they seem to be more and more prevalent. You see them more and more often. I've even heard people getting them for freebies, which blows my mind. So I love that they're so readily available. Apparently, people are having a better time breeding them, which is great. So to start off, well, let's talk about the care. We're going to go through the care as far as slings, juveniles, and adults, young adults. I will talk about some changes I have made in my care because I've definitely changed things over the years. And that's one of the reasons I like doing these is I go back and I listen to stuff. And there are things, I went back and listened to the old Therafosa podcast I did, and there are things in there I do differently now, which is one of the reasons why I like to periodically do one of these update videos to give people, is the information in there, did it work? Yes, it did. But did I change things? Yes, there are things I do differently. And I always think it's important if you're a keeper to recognize when you're evolving your keeping, when you're changing some things up. And I think it's important when you're a keeper who puts a lot of their stuff online through videos and podcasts to make sure you share that with people. Hey, you know, what I did before, I wouldn't necessarily say it's wrong, but this is working better for me now. This is what I've done. So we'll talk about some of that as we go. So one thing we want to get out of the way right off the bat is this is considered to be, all three of these are considered to be moisture-dependent species, although the Sturmey has been around in the hobby for a long time and seems to be very, very hardy. I would not encourage this. Please understand, I'm not saying do this, but I have heard from people that keep their Sturmeys on dry substrate with a large water dish or two. I would not advise that. I do not think we're at that level. I think they need, with those big book lungs they have, they need that moist substrate to make sure they're not losing too much moisture through the book lungs. So I would not play with dry substrate. However, people have grown them up on dry substrate and have had success with them. Probably just their adaptability, but that's all three species are ones that I would definitely keep moist. Now, how do you keep moist spiders moist? Remember, we don't get caught up in humidity. Is humidity something that is important? Sure, they need to have some air humidity, but it's more about, again, keeping those book lungs moist, giving them a spot, allowing them to be able to adjust how much humidity they need. So the keys to doing that, this is how I do it, is deep moist substrate. What I like to do is at all stages, and we're going to talk about how I've changed how I keep the adults now to make sure that I'm able to better do this. At all stages, they should have enough substrate to be able to burrow in. They like burrowing right through adulthood. This is something, when I first got in, everybody's like, oh, they're terrestrial. Throw them on, you know, a couple inches of substrate with a water dish, keep the substrate moist, and spray it down every once in a while. They'll be fine. And what I found is giving them that room to burrow, you get a calmer spider. They have that burrow to kind of use as their home base. Plus, it allows them to kind of regulate how much moisture they're getting. Now, the trick to moisture-dependent spiders, this is where a lot of us, I remember I was the same way when I first started. I'd read something was moisture dependent. I would look into the enclosure, see that the top started drying out. I would freak out, start pouring water on the top, and pretty soon that enclosure was sopping wet. The trick is to let the top layers can dry out a bit. That's how you keep from getting fungus and mold and things of that nature. You allow the top layers to dry out, you keep the bottom layers moist. The best way to do that, deep substrate. The choice of what you use for substrate is important. That's something I'm realizing the longer I'm in the hobby, is that sometimes it's best to mix your own with the characteristics you need for a particular species. So for example, for years I was using topsoil, and back when I had my Sturmey, I used basically straightforward topsoil. And the problem I had with that was when it started off moist, it was great. When it dried out, it was ridiculously difficult to rehydrate. You would pour water in, and no matter what you did, the water would pool on the top, create mud, and it just wasn't very efficient as far as grabbing that moisture and pulling it, sucking it down to the lower levels. So I started experimenting with other substrates. I've used BioDude. BioDude works great. Again, it can be a little tricky to rehydrate. That was my only issue with BioDude. Does it hold on to moisture? Well, yes, but is it tricky when it starts to dry out? Yes, it can be a little trickier, but it worked great for years. Nowadays, I'm back to mixing my own. Not only is it, I did a whole podcast on this, so people that are just joining me, feel free to check that podcast out. But the one I'm going to be using for my new enclosures, I have three of them set up right now for my adults, is a combination of peat, cocoa fiber, a little topsoil thrown in, and then some vermiculite in this case. Now, you can use vermiculite, you can use shredded sphagnum moss. Whatever you use, the vermiculite allows it to kind of suck up that moisture really well, and it tends to hold on to it really well. A trick with the adults, what I do with the vermiculite is I put a layer of it on the bottom of the enclosure, not particularly deep, maybe a half an inch layer, wet it down really good, and then start putting the moist regular mix substrate on top of it. That lower level, when you pour water down the sides, because that's how I add water to them, I pour the water down the sides, let it trickle between the side of the enclosure and the substrate, so it goes down in the bottom. You'll see it sucks, that vermiculite sucks it all up in the bottom and then holds it there, which works great for me. So that's the trick for these. That's what I've been using for these. It's like that I will go, it usually starts off as like a 40-40-20 mix. So 40% peat, 40% cocoa fiber, mix those together. Usually what I do is rehydrate the cocoa fiber. So it's obviously damp because I've added water to it. And then I go ahead and add the peat in, which is always bone dry, mix them together. It gets a nice, you know, a nice level of moisture in it. Then I sprinkle in some of the vermiculite. And then usually what I can do is I can add some sand, I can add some topsoil, whatever. But those are what I've been using lately. Obviously, feel free to use what works for you. I will have folks ask me, and let's get this out of the way, I don't use false bottoms. I have done false bottoms before. They're fine. For me, they're more trouble than they're worth because I've had great luck with just using deep substrate and using a good mixture that allows the water to absorb into the substrate. However, is it wrong to do false bottoms? No, feel free to do whatever. If you want to do a false bottom, just make sure you set them up right. You know, you have your layer of sometimes clay balls. I use some stuff I got from any herp, I think, and it was like crushed glass, but it worked the same way. You put your layer of screen on top of it, you put your substrate in there, the spider can, you know, dig or whatever, whatever works for you. I don't need to do it. I've never done it in years of keeping, but there are people that do it and they're successful with it. And some people think it gives them, you know, it gives them a better peace of mind, because obviously if you're pouring that water down and then there's those voids there between the clay balls, that water can fill up that spot. It's easier to maintain. So whatever works for you. I don't do it. People ask, why don't you do this? Or, you know, have you ever given this a try? Yeah, I have. It worked fine, but it's extra steps after extra materials that I have to buy that really doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't give me anything else than what I've been using. So if you use it, fine, that's okay. There's obviously a lot of videos out there showing how to do that. And by all means, emulate that. It still gives you, you know, have that deep substrate on top of it, allow for it to burrow, you know, and go ahead and make sure that spider stays well and hydrated. So now that we've got that out of the way, what we're going to do is start with slings first. Now, slings of these three species are huge, larger than some juveniles of other species. And I'm talking about 1.5 to 1.75 inches, or 3.81 to 4.45 centimeters. Now, a lot of times we talk about slings, we say put them in around a 16-ounce deli cup or 32-ounce deli cup. Unfortunately, with a sling that starts off that large, those are too small. One molt, it's too big. And I've been there where you're going to put it in the deli cup. I remember when I first got my T. Sturmey slings. I set up some 16-ounce deli cups. I put one of them in the deli cup and I looked at them like, there's no way. So I ended up at that time, I was using the Mainstay, their 2-quart clear canisters, and I set them up at that. That gave them a lot of room to grow. They got a few molts out of them before they had to be moved out of those. I don't use those so much anymore. What I've been using for my juveniles of larger species now is the Sterilite ID latch that's about 7.5 by 5.5 by 6 inches high, or 19.4 by 14.2 by 15.2 centimeters. These give a little extra space, obviously a lot extra space than a 16-ounce deli cup, give them some room to grow, and more importantly, give them some room to dig and burrow. These slings, that people don't realize this, they like to dig. They will do a lot of digging, most of them. I know somebody's going to come by and go, mine never dug. We always have those oddballs. Mine all like to dig. So I usually like to give them a sling size 3 to 4 inches of substrate, or 7.6 to 10.16 centimeters of substrate. I give them a cork hide with the starter burrow. I give them a water dish, and we make sure that water dish is full of water and clean at all time. Again, moisture dependent species, moist substrate is one of the keys. Water dish, full water dish, another key to make sure that they can stay hydrated. And then obviously I put sphagnum moss in. I will sometimes put leaf litter in because I just like the looks of it, but very easy to set up. And the trick is just to make sure that substrate doesn't dry off too much. So you watch what I like to do. As you can tell when the substrate's moist, because it'll be darker, the moist stuff is darker, the drier stuff is lighter. There'll be a line of demarcation on the side of the enclosure. You'll be able to see that the light substrate will start, that line will start getting lower and lower and lower. So you may have the top half is dry, then the top inch, then the top inch and a half. When it starts getting to the point where, you know, there's more dry up top than moist on the bottom, you want to add some more moisture to it to make sure it doesn't dry out too much. But a note about slings of all three species. I've kept slings of all three species. This is something that often isn't mentioned, and I try to mention it all mine so people are prepared for it, because we talk about speed in spiders. And we talk about, you know, a lot of times it's the arboreal species that we're like, wow, they're super fast. And obviously they are the Pisolotheria species, Salmopeus, Tapenkinius, All the arboreal species can be very, very fast as slings, but what I don't hear talked about a lot is how fast Theraphosa species can be. The slings are very, very leggy, and with those long, lithe legs comes ridiculous bursts of speed. They are very, very fast. Now, I'm not telling people this to scare them off. No, not at all. I am telling them this to be careful and be aware, because I have had people that have come back after I've done, you know, a podcast, or the last podcast, or some of my videos on them, and say, man, you weren't kidding. These things can boogie. And that's one of the reasons we also want to make sure that our slings have room to burrow, because I found that if given the ability to flee, they will just boop right in the burrow and they're gone. If you have a situation where they get a little too big for the enclosure, they're caught out in the open, now you have a possibility of this spider bolting and escaping. So that's something to always keep in mind, that they are very, very, very fast as slings. Now, with that speed comes some amazing feeding responses. These things are a blast to feed. They eat a lot. They hunt. They actively hunt, run across, grab things. They hit like trucks. And because they start off as an inch and a half or so, you're talking they're going to be eating medium crickets to medium B. lateralis roaches, mealworms, right off the bat. Now, think about that. Think about how many tiny slings you've kept that you're pre-killing stuff because the slings are too small to take it. These things are taking like almost adult size prey. They put a couple size, they hit around 2 inches or so, they'll eat large crickets, no problem. So that's something to keep in mind, that they're going to eat larger prey right off the bat. Now, one thing that I've had people tell me before, and it's something to think about, if you're feeding them larger prey, please keep in mind that slings can fill up very quickly on larger prey items. So what that means is you may feed your spider, maybe you're feeding your inch and a half one a large cricket, you feed it another large cricket, and all of a sudden it stops eating. And I get emails, Tom, I don't know what's happening. I fed my T. sturmi sling twice and it's not eating anymore. Well, there's a very good chance if you fed it a prey that's as big as its body that it probably fed up in two feedings. So that's something to keep in mind. They can do that. I've had it happen with mine where they eat two big meals. That's it. They're done. Now, as far as feeding schedules, this is one of the things I went back to the video and I've changed, at least with my adults, but my feeding schedule used to be more aggressive. I do keep a more aggressive feeding schedule with slings because I want to get them out of that delicate sling stage as quickly as possible. And with these guys, it's very easy to get them out of that stage. So with slings, I used to feed my slings twice a week. Keep in mind, they're gluttons. They'll eat. Some of them will eat right up to almost a day. They molt, but a decent sized meal twice a week works. A decent size, a bigger meal once a week is fine. You can feed them every other week. I just try to get them out of that sling stage as quickly as possible, especially because these are moisture dependent species. You want them to put on, you know, some more size and get out of that stage where they're a little more susceptible to drying out. Now, some folks keep these. Again, they freak out because they're eating and all of a sudden they stop eating. Well, that is probably pre-molt. These guys have a couple telltale signs of pre-molt. Number one, I've had them bury themselves. I've had them bury themselves in their burrows. They sometimes close them off. More often than not, they don't come out very often. You'll go to drop a prey at them in, they won't come out. That's a good sign that they're in pre-molt. They do become a little more lethargic, I've found. They sit around. You might find one sitting like at the mouth of its burrow, not moving very much. They get very, very fat. So those are things to keep in mind. Now, one thing that I sometimes hear from keepers that don't have a lot of experience that kind of it drives me a little nuts is they will tell me, hey, I just figured out my spider is in pre-molt, so I'm going to go ahead and pour a bunch of water in there now. You need to keep these guys moist at all time. When you figure out your spider's in pre-molt, when it's lethargic, when it's getting close to molt, I'll hear some folks even say, yeah, it's been several weeks, it hasn't eaten, it's close to molting, so I'm going to go ahead and moisten things down. It should be moist at all times. Do not let things dry out. That's when you run into molt issues, because adding a bunch of water, they're not sponges. Adding a bunch of water after they're already in that pre-molt cycle, after they're getting, you know, when they're getting ready to molt, what they're doing is they will pump fluid between the old and new exoskeleton so that they can slip out of it. And if they don't have enough fluid to do that, that's when you get molting problems. So make sure they don't dry out in between. That's one of the biggest mistakes I see people committing with moisture-dependent species, is they let things dry out and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's in molt, now I've got to add water. No, it's often too late at that point. Make sure they have water dishes at all times. Make sure that substrate doesn't dry out. Now, as far as ventilation, this is something that needs to be mentioned. A lot of old literature, and unfortunately some of it's still out there, it says that to keep the inside of the enclosure suitably humid, you need to block off ventilation or not put a lot of ventilation in. I disagree with that totally. You want good ventilation. You want good cross ventilation. Personally, I prefer enclosures that have holes around all the sides, because think about it. If you have a room where there's airflow, that's going to allow the air to pass on through and clean out any of that stagnant air. Even better, some folks like to have a fan going, especially in the summertime. Just be careful to turn it off if you're doing rehousings, because it'll launch those urticating hairs. But having a fan going on low, or an oscillating fan, just getting the air flowing through that room will help greatly to keep those enclosures from becoming too stagnant. Now, I've had people ask me, is it better to have top ventilation or side ventilation? I like side ventilation. Top ventilation is fine. It tends to allow the water to evaporate more quickly. We did an experiment with this, my son and I, years ago, and the enclosure, we had two enclosures, one that was side ventilated, one that was top ventilated. The top ventilated one did evaporate much more quickly. The water was evaporating out. But is it bad to have top ventilation? No, just recognize if you have top ventilation that you're going to need to spend extra time and be extra careful making sure that things don't dry out too quickly. I actually have my Theraphosa apophysis in an enclosure we'll talk about in a minute that has a lot of top. That's got the perforated steel on top. So it's got a lot of top ventilation and side ventilation. I just have to be a little more diligent with keeping things moist. I could block it off. I thought about blocking it off this winter, but it seems to be doing fine, so I'm not going to. So that's something to keep in mind when you're going ahead and putting those holes in your enclosures. Try to do it around the sides. Putting a couple on top doesn't hurt. Just know that you're going to have to be extra diligent making sure things do not dry out. So you have your slings. They're eating great. They're growing like weeds. These guys grow super fast. We'll get into some of the growth rates in a minute, but know that both the Sturmey and Blondie can easily hit 5 to even 6 inches the first year. The Apophysis, Apophysis, in my experience, a little slower growing, but still 4 inches or so in the first year, so a lot of growth. But now we're looking at juvenile enclosures, and I usually like to move mine when they hit around 3 inches or 4 inches, 7.62 centimeters or so. And in the past, I've used the M-Design stackable closet plastic containers. They're 12.75 inches by 7.25 by 7 inches or 32.4 by 18.4 by 18 centimeters. And those work well. I've used other things in the past for my spiders back when, a few years ago when I had the Blondies. I use these smaller Tupperware type containers, but I don't use those anymore. So I'm not going to bother mentioning them because I've graduated away from that. These I like because they offer some decent size. Again, depth. They will allow enough room for substrate for them to dig and burrow in. And again, we want to put in at least 3 or 4 inches, or probably closer to 4 or 5 inches of moist substrate. We want to put in a starter burrow. We want to put in cork bark hide, maybe a couple cork bark hides. We want water dish. We want some sphagnum moss, all the regular fixings. But these work well, but just know if you use them for Apophysis, they work great. I was able to keep my Apophysis in them for, I think, for well over a year. One of them's still in it, I believe. And it worked out pretty well for them because they're a little more slow growing. However, with a Blondie or Sturmey, they're going to outgrow it pretty quickly. So what I've done, one of the changes I've made is that I used to use the Clearview latch. These are the ones I use for a lot of my large-bodied terrestrials, like my Formictopus, my Panthobedius, Lasiodora. I love these. They're 17 inches by 11 and an eighth by 6.5 deep, or 42.2 by 28.3 by 15.5 centimeters. And I used to put larger specimens in those. These are great for juvenile Theraphosa species. Now, you want to put a lot of dirt in there. You want to load the dirt up on one side. Again, give them, they're a little more shallow, but having the dirt up to like 4 or 5 inches on one side sloping down works great. You put the cork bark hide, you put the starter burrow in, all your fixing leaves room for a nice big water dish. They work great. Now, could you keep a larger specimen in it? Well, I have one of my T Blondies that's about 9 inches in one now, and she's done fine in it. She's calm. There's no issues. I'm able to keep it suitably moist. She's got a big two water dishes in it. However, it's not big enough for her. Let's call it as it is. And this is, I've been just waiting for her to molt out so I can put her into the other enclosure. I have a 10-gallon one that we'll talk about in a minute ready for her. But those give you some room to work with as far as, because they're going to hit that 5-inch mark maybe in the first year or so. at least four inches, and then they slow down a bit. Now, do they still grow well and quickly? Yeah, I'd say they're still fast growers after that, and they still put on massive size with each molt, but that will, the Sterilite 17-inch by 11 by 6.5 ones will last you a little while and give you some time until you figure out what you're going to put in them in as adults. Now, another thing I get asked about, ExoTerra mini cubes, the 12 by 12 by 12 or 30.5 centimeter cube enclosures, can they work for adults? I would say they're too small for a full-fledged adult. However, I think they're a good juvenile young adult type enclosure. I've seen setups with these where they look great. The spider's got enough room to do what they need to do. Just recognize that once they hit, you know, around 7 or 8 inches, you're going to have to move them into something else because they may be a bit too small. And recognize that because of the doors, the front opening doors and the shorter, the more shallow litter dam up front, you're going to have to slope the substrate up from the front. So the front, I think the dam is probably about 4 inches or so, 4.5 inches maybe. So you can start it 4 inches. You don't want to cover up the vents on the front and then slope it. I've sloped it up to like 7-8 inches or so up in the back. And then basically you make your burrow going into that and they seem to do well like that. They'll go in and adapt to that burrow. You want to use cork bark. Cork bark rounds work great for that type of thing. You put the cork bark round so it's kind of going into the ground, clear out some of the dirt. They'll use a grate or cork bark flat will work. Those can work fine, but again, just recognize that would not be the spider's forever home. It'd be a beautiful home for a bit while they're in the juvenile to young adult stage, but eventually they're going to size out of those. Now, again, just like with the slings, we want to make sure things don't dry out. We want to make sure things stay moist. So again, pack in that substrate, keep it moist, water dishes, multiple water dishes. That's another trick that people use sometimes. I've used it before. I just mentioned my T. Blondie is in one where she's got a small water dish and a big water dish. It gives her multiple ways for the moisture to evaporate into the air, keep things suitably moist in there. But you want to make sure that everything stays moist all the way through. Again, the bigger, I've found that almost, and I've heard other people say this, it's almost more important when they get larger to make sure they stay hydrated, because when they get larger, they can lose some of that moisture through respiration. If things dry out, that can take a toll on them, especially if they go into that pre-molt. They need even more moisture. If you see the size of these things when they molt and how much fluid is on them, it's pretty impressive how much they lose. This is why I just had somebody message me the other day on a tarantula video saying, yeah, you should tell people that if they're hungry enough, they can eat their own molts. And I had to explain, wait a minute, they're not eating the molts. That's happening after they molt. They're trying to regain some of that moisture back that they lost during the molting process. So they roll it up much in the same way they'd roll up a praetum, and they suck up all that moisture again to reuse it, to recycle it. So that's not them eating the molts. They're recycling it. And I have seen, this is why it's sometimes difficult to get molts for mine, because I've seen them molt and there's like puddles of liquid in the carapace and on the abdominal skin. So you can see why they want to reclaim that. But if you have a nice moist environment around them with water dishes, that prevents them from potentially drying out and having a bad molt. Now, as far as feeding is concerned, juveniles are eating like what most adult spiders eat. They're bigger. Juveniles, we're talking 3 to 4 inches, are already a decent sized spider. They'll eat large crickets. I've had them eat large dubia roaches, which are pretty big. Mealworms, superworms, locusts, whatever you're doing. Again, as far as a schedule, once a week is pretty good if you're giving them larger meals. Once a month is fine. At this point, we can slow down. They're established. They fatten up. They can fatten up very quickly. I've seen a lot of very bulbous booties when it comes to Theraphosa species because I think they're just so much fun to eat and they're gluttons. But now that I've, and this is one of the things, again, that I talked about earlier that I've changed, now that I've been in the hobby for a while, I'm trying not to fatten things up to the point where it could cause problems. So mine right now, when they were juveniles, it was like every 2 weeks they'd get fed. Now you can give them a few crickets, one big dubia roach, whatever it may be. Again, if you feed them bigger meals, you have to feed them less often. It's funny because when I started getting these guys, I've had people come on the videos, and I mentioned this in the earlier podcast I did 4 years ago. There's this myth out there that Theraphosa species have to be fed constantly or they die, which is BS. That's not true. They're just like any other spider. You feed them, they fatten up. They're not going to die. If you give them a month off, you give them 2 months off, they're going to be perfectly fine. So please don't prescribe to that nonsense. It's not true. Feed them whatever works for you, but I think once they're in that larger size where they're 3 to 4 inches or so, you can definitely slow things down a bit. Now, we're on to the adult phase. And again, there's a lot of different alternatives out there for adult enclosures. I've got mine in some now, and I will tell you right off the bat that a couple of the ones I'm using, I will probably have to rehouse them eventually, and I'll explain that when we get to it. But When we talk about adults, I'm going to talk about specimens that are 5 to 6 inches. Is that probably juveniles? It probably still technically speaking a juvenile, considering these spiders can get to be 10 to 12 inches. 5 to 6 inches is only half grown. Many spiders, that would only be juvenile stage. But when they, you'll see they get to a point where in their 5 to 6 inch stage, they're starting to look like adults. Are they full-fledged adults? Are they young adults? Are they juvenile? Who knows? But that's what we're talking about as far as when we're going to rehouse them. That's 12.7 centimeters by 15.24 centimeters, 15.24 centimeters or so. So we're talking about, in most cases, that would be a full adult spider of many other species. Now, some of the things I've used for adults, again, I talked about that I've used the Sterilite containers for adults before. I no longer use those, the flatter ones for adults. I have right now, my Apophysis is in a barbarous or slash reptile growth 10-gallon pet tank. They're about 19.25 inches by 9.5 inches by 10.5 inches high, or 50 by 24.3 by 26.7 centimeters. It allowed me, this enclosure allowed me to put in a lot of substrate, about 6-7 inches of substrate. Again, that moist stuff that I mixed up myself. I was able to put in 2 cork bark hides, one on each end, and allowed the spider to choose. She used one for a bit, and then she went over, dug a burrow in the other one. She's got a nice little burrow. She's able to hide in it. There's enough space. When she comes out and about, every once in a while, I'll come up at night with a flashlight and she'll be sitting up there on the surface, you know, hiding out, waiting for something to come. She doesn't roam too far from her burrow entrance. And as soon as I disturb her, she goes right back into her burrow, which is fine because we'll talk about the temperaments of these species in a minute. So that's been working out. However, T. apophysis can get big. They're leggy. They can get up to 10 inches or so. If she hits 9, 10 inches, will I consider putting her into something larger? Yes, absolutely. I'll play it by ear. Right now, when I see her out on the surface, it works. She's probably around the 8-inch mark now, I would guess. We'll see what happens when she molts again. But right now, I think it's working great for her. It's a good size. I also have one set up right now for her sister that will be getting moved very soon. I just checked on her yesterday. I was waiting for her to molt. I checked yesterday. She had molted. About the same size now, so she'll be one of the ones we'll be moving in that video. So she'll be going in one as well. Can you put them in something bigger? Absolutely. And I'm never one to deter, especially larger spiders. I know we talk about cage size a lot, but for larger spiders, you can put them in bigger stuff as long as there's no risk of fall damage. You can give them multiple hides. You give them room to move. That allows you to plant the enclosures, whatever you want. But this is working so far for me. Now, as far as my blondie, my blondies are both good. Well, one's already in a 10-gallon Lorex acrylic enclosure. It's about 11 by 11 by 24 inches or 28 by 28 by 61 centimeters. I have an identical one that I bought at the same time I bought this one for my other female. She's going into that. That's all set up. I set that one up with about 7 inches of that substrate mix with that layer of vermiculite on the bottom, a big old cork bark hide with a starter burrow, some sphagnum moss, some leaf litter. I did not put a plant in this one. When I rehoused my other blondie, I did put a plant in with her. It was fine for about a year, and then one day she came out and just ripped it to shreds. So I'm not wasting plants anymore. I feel bad every time they kill a plant. If I were to do it again and try to put plants, I'd probably do a much, much larger enclosure to have room, suitable room for the plants in there as well. But my other one's been doing great. She has a burrow that goes down. The substrate's probably about 8 inches at one end, and she has a burrow that goes down under the cork bark. But most of the time, she's sitting up loud and proud right on the surface in the mouth of that burrow. She's webbed all in front of it, and she just sits there. And she's very, very calm, which is nice because I love looking at her. She's enormous. So the other one will be going into that as well. I think the 10 gallons right now, while they're around 9 inches, probably to 10 inches. I know we think, and that's one thing we need to consider, is when we think a 10-inch leg span, I'm holding my hands out right now. I'm thinking, like, was it a basketball, probably around 10 inches or so? That's huge. But remember, they're not splayed out all the time like that. They're up on their toes. So they're much smaller than 10 inches across when they're like that. So that's something to keep in mind, because when you see this one in her enclosure, even though she's probably 9 inches, over 9 inches now, she doesn't look too big for the enclosure. She looks fine with it. She looks like she has room to go out and explore. She can go to a water dish, which I don't see her go over to that all that often. She's got a big water dish, but she looks fine. Now, if they continue to put on more size, would I rehouse them? Yes. I'm eyeing 15-gallon ones, maybe even a 20-gallon long type one, the really big one. There's definitely other options there, but right now this will hold her and her sister for quite some time. Now, if you can't get Lorex enclosures where you are, they went up in price. I did get these in a really really good price back in the day, and now they went up a bit. I'm sure something around that, anywhere 10 to 20 gallons long. Remember, you don't want wire mesh on the top. That's another thing people screw up sometimes, is they can't find anything suitably big enough, so they pick up an aquarium and put the ones that have the wire sliding tops with the wire mesh. They can get their toe claws caught in that. It can lead to death. As a matter of fact, one of the spiders that I actually saw pictures of that got its legs caught and lost two legs, the guy came home and they were hanging from, I believe, was an adult T. sturmi. So make sure you find something that's appropriately sized. Now, here is where things get tricky, because you have this large, beautiful spider and you want to show it off. However, you're struggling to find a beautiful enclosure that is suitable for it. Always remember to put the spider first when selecting an enclosure. And what that means is, if you can't, you have to do a rehousing, you can't find a suitable enclosure, don't be afraid to put it in something like a Sterilite bin or something that's large, that allows you to alter that enclosure so that it's appropriate. You want that side ventilation, good depth. I use these, I think they were Ziploc ones. They were like 2 feet square. They were big, they were deep, they made excellent enclosures for larger spiders. The downside, they didn't look very pretty. But if you opened up the enclosure and the spider came, it looked good from the top down. It's just from the side, it was that milky plastic. And I had people once on a video where I had them in something similar go, why would you put such a beautiful spider in that? Well, because it's an appropriate setup. It allowed me to put in 7 inches, keep that of substrate, keep it moist, multiple hides. You can do a lot with an enclosure like that. So please keep that in mind, that when it comes down to keeping a large moisture-dependent species like a Theraphosa, always put the spider's needs over the aesthetics. You can always find something later on. It's going to be expensive to get a big old enclosure for it, but always put the spider's need first. Now, while we are talking about pretty enclosures, if somebody out there has their Theraphosa species in something pretty, a proper setup that's nice, whether it be glass, whether it be plastic. I know overseas you guys use a lot more glass than we have over here in the U.S. So basically for glass, we have the Exoterras and we have fish tanks. That's pretty much what we have. There's not a lot out there, but I know there's a lot more available over there. I would love to hear what you guys are putting yours in, if you're putting them in nice enclosures, because I'm always on the lookout too. I'm about to do that big enclosure video with, I talk about all the different types of enclosures I've used and, you know, pros and cons, and I would love to have a couple more things to show off. I do find the Lorax plastic ones, I really like those. They have the hinge tops. He makes them in a lot of different sizes. They're on eBay, and if you play your cards right, he has a lot of good sales sometimes where you can get them like shipped, like one price with the enclosure, ship, free shipping, and it's decent. But just recognize, the bigger the enclosure, especially when you're talking about acrylic or glass, the more it's going to cost. They're going to be expensive, but if you're going to have a big, beautiful spider in it, the cost is usually worth it. And remember, when setting up the adults, this is something I've changed. Back in the day, I mentioned this earlier, I would have my adults on like, you know, a few inches of substrate, nothing huge. It would evaporate much more quickly. They couldn't do any burrowing. I no longer keep them like that. I think that enclosure that allows for that deep substrate, at least 5 to 6 inches or 12.7 to 5.24 centimeters, is appropriate. So make sure whatever you use allows that them room to burrow. These guys, I know they've said they're terrestrials, and I think we got caught up in the hobby for years over terrestrials means you just put them on a couple inches of substrate. And I think the majority of us realize that a lot of the adults will continue to burrow, and you'll have a happier spider overall if they want to burrow and you give them the room. So give them the room to burrow. My adult female, like I said, my Apophysis, still burrows. She's about 8 inches now. My 9+ inch T. blondie still burrows. The other one isn't burrowing because she's in an older enclosure style, but she will be burrowing soon because I gave her an enclosure with a lot of substrate room to burrow. And the T. sturmi, still burrowing. I went to feed her the other day, bolted right to her burrow, which is good because she's a crazy little gal. So make sure you give them room to burrow. Again, large water dishes are great. Big, I've had ones with a 5 to 6 inch circumference on them. Multiple dishes works. Whatever, it's just an extra insurance policy to make sure the spider has the moisture it needs when it's time to molt. Because what will happen is they'll go into that pre-molt, and if the water isn't there when they need it, you're going to be in some trouble. And as I mentioned earlier, this would be, people ask me, what are good spiders to try like a big planted enclosure for? This would be one that I think would be appropriate for, especially if you gave it a much larger enclosure, work some plants in, work some feeder insects in, whatever it may be. These would be good ones because they are moisture dependent. So you're always going to have to keep those plants watered. It's not going to bother the spider. You can have those, you know, springtails or whatever in there. And I think it would make for a beautiful enclosure. I say in a bigger enclosure because, as I found with mine, it wasn't a small enclosure by any stretch of the imagination. imagination, but she eventually went out and decided to rip that plant up. So they can be, spiders are temperamental like that, where they are fine with a plant and then all of a sudden they decide, you know what, I'm going to do some clearing, and they just take it down. So definitely a species that could look great in a big, large planted enclosure. Like you see some of those naturalistic ones people do. And I've seen some beautiful, beautiful enclosures that are appropriate for the spider. Now, feeding, as we mentioned, these guys are gluttons. But remember, that when you've got a 9-inch spider, a large cricket isn't very big for it. So if you're going to feed it large crickets, know that you're going to have to feed it multiples at a time. What I like to do is after they have a molt, I feed them a couple adult dubia to get them kind of fattened up. And then I go either with, you know, a bunch of large crickets or back to dubia, whatever it may be. But just know they are big, beefy spiders. So just know that it can take them a while to put on some weight after a molt. And speaking of molting, one thing to look out for, the pre-molt period for some of these guys can be quite extensive, especially I found if you got a mature male, that final molt where it goes into pre-molt before its final molt can be very long. My male was, I think 7 or 8 months it took it to finally molt it, and it actually made a burrow, buried itself, and then finally came out. It was a mature male. So again, allowing them to burrow is huge. I found that they will often retreat to their burrows. They don't fill them up. As adults, they usually leave them open. They don't web them. They don't fill, bury themselves, but they'll spend a lot of time down there probably because it's more moist. And my Sturmi, that's how I knew she was in pre-molt. She's usually out when I take her enclosure off the shelf. And what happened was a few times I checked on her to go feed her. She was down in her burrow, stayed in her burrow, molted in her burrow. Same thing with my big girl, my T Blondie. Last time she got ready to molt, she spent a lot of time in her burrow. And then I saw her come up, start webbing and lay down. When they molt, they will lay down, kick off all of those hairs off of their abdomens and lay down this carpet of itch. It's just, you look at it, you want to itch, and they will cover themselves with it. And that's something to keep in mind, because the first time I saw this, I couldn't figure out what the heck was happening. I thought there was some kind of creeping mold that got onto my spider, because they're just fluffy, covered in all this fluffy hair. And that's to protect them, because in the wild, if they flip over and they're unprotected, something comes over, it's an easy meal. However, they put those hairs on them, something comes sniffing by, it's going to have a really bad day. So keep that in mind when they molt. They will actually lay down, you'll see them lay down the web, and a lot of times they kick that all the rest of the hairs off their abdomen down. So you'll know it's coming. The molt is imminent. It's coming soon. But they do become more reclusive when in pre-molts, is something to know. And also another thing with them, when they get larger, always remember that the recovery time after a molt to when they're ready to eat again becomes longer and longer the larger the spider is. It takes them longer and longer to harden up, for those fangs to harden up. So recognize it can be weeks when after a large Theraphosa molts before it's ready to take a meal. I just had somebody contact me when my 8-inch Theraphosa Sturmi just molted. It's been 2 weeks. I tossed in a roach. She didn't seem to want it too early. They need a lot longer time than that. I usually wait at least 3 or 4 weeks before trying to offer something, and I will put it in there immediately. If it doesn't pounce on it right off the bat, I take it right out because it's not ready. I had one of them go, I believe the longest one I had after wait to eat after a pre-molt period was around 6 weeks before she finally took a meal. And I was getting a little worried because I'm like, oh, come on, girl. It's been a while. You got to eat. They're fine. Just know that the molting period, the pre-molt period can be longer, and the period before they're ready to eat again can be longer. So don't rush it. You don't want one that has a partially hardened fang to jump the gun and snap off a fang or break a fang trying to hunt. Make sure you give them their time to harden up. Now, while we're talking about general care of them, let's take a moment to talk about temperatures. Back when I first got mine, there was a lot of stuff out there that said that all Theraphosa species needed to be kept at very high temperatures, usually 80 to 85 or so, or else they won't eat well, they won't grow, they'll have molt problems, and it's just not true. My original T. Sturmis that I got as slings, I got them in the wintertime, and at this point, the temperatures in my tarantula room were usually low 70s to even high 60s. It would dip a bit. They grew like weeds. They ate, they grew, they were active. They hit 5 inches or 12.7 centimeters their first year. So that kind of prove right there. Now, would I keep them, like when we say room temperature, I'm always talking about at least high 60s to mid 70s is room temperature. So let's clarify that. Would I keep them at long periods of time at 65 degrees or low? No, I would not. Would I let it dip lower than that? I probably would not, at least for not. I will say there was times where we lost power, where the temperatures dropped to 50. They all survived because it was all a short period of time. But overall, if your temperatures are in the high 60s, mid 70s, you're fine. They will do fine. Back then, it was high 60s, low 70s in the winter, high 70s to 80 in the summer. Nowadays, my temperatures are 72 to 73 degrees in the winter, although I do have times where the heat can't keep up for a little bit and it'll drop down to the 60s, but usually right around 72, 73. And then in the summer, it's 80s with it sometimes hitting 88, 90. Usually at that point, I kick on AC because I've noticed that when it gets too hot, they're all out and about. And I don't think it's a good thing. They're not like, hey, this is warm, this is nice. It's more they're trying to escape the heat and they don't know where to go. So I usually try to keep it in the 80s. They do just fine. Now, that said, higher temps can lead to faster metabolisms, faster growth rates. However, I would love to see if you got a spider that goes from, you know, an inch and a half to 5 inches to 6 inches in a year, even with those temps, I'm guessing they could be monstrous in a year if you kept them in the 80s. So is it wrong to keep them in the 80s? No. Do you need to keep them in the 80s? No, you do not. A lot of us keep them at those lower temperatures, experience very active and lively spiders that eat great and grow quickly. Another thing that should be mentioned, these are obviously New World species, and as such, they have urticating hairs or bristles that they can kick from their abdomens in way of defense. We just talked about them laying down the carpet. It should be noted that Theraphosa species are considered to have some of the worst urticating hairs out there. A lot of people are very, very sensitive to them. I'm, knock on wood, fortunate that I've been exposed a couple of times, and it really hasn't been that bad. And always remember, I have people come on and say, well, that one doesn't bother me at all. It's kind of your personal body chemistry that determines which ones are going to affect you more. So for example, the LPs, the Lazy Door Parahibana, those hairs really bother me a lot, and some people, they don't bother at all. The Theraphosa species, the Nandu, I haven't had a lot of trouble with. They're usually considered to be some of the worst hairs. So recognize hairs are no joke. You always want to be careful of that. So anytime you're, you know, doing rehousings or cleaning, make sure you protect your hands. I would encourage people to put gloves on to make sure that you're not getting those hairs in there, especially if you're taking things out of the enclosure, because when they lay down that blanket of hair before they molt, those hairs don't go anywhere. Those are in that enclosure. They work their way into the substrate and the webbing, into the sphagnum moss. So if you reach in there and grab something, you're going to get haired. So you want to be careful of that, because remember, with urticating hairs, apparently, the more you get exposed to them, the less resistant you are to them, the more they can affect you, which is the opposite of usually things like that. And I've heard many people that cannot even keep Theraphosa species and be in a room with them, because they go in the room with the Theraphosa species and they start breaking out and itching. So I never want to get to that point. I'm sure everybody out there that wants to keep these never wants to get to that point. I have not, knock on wood, had a lot of problem with mine, but again, it could just be that I'm more resistant to that compared to other species. So always keep that in mind. You don't want to play around with the hairs. Speaking of hairs, temperament-wise, these guys can be all over the place. I've been lucky to have, for the most part, very, very calm. My T. blondii were always, you know, a little skittish as slings, fairly calm. My T. apophysis, much more skittish than the other species, the other two species. They would sometimes bolt around. Sometimes I'd get some hairs kicked at me. The T. sturmes that I've raised up, the first ones I raised up, no problems whatsoever. Very laid back, no kicking. A little skittish, but they calmed down greatly. When they were adults, they were fine. My new one has been rather, like, crazy, for lack of a better term. She's been very, very skittish. She would bolt around. She would kick some hairs. She just molted, and she's now seems to be calming down a bit. So I'm hoping with each subsequent molt that she'll calm down. I found that once they get larger size, they tend to be a little more calm, but I have heard from people that have big ones that are nasty. I haven't gotten any threat postures out of mine. I think I got one. I dropped a cricket on an apophysis once, and it threw up a threat posture. But again, the fangs weren't bared. It was kind of a get the heck out of here. Not a lot of threat postures, which is good, because I would guess getting a threat posture from a 10 to 12 inch spider could be quite intimidating for most people. So temperaments can vary wildly, but recognize on the worst end of it, you're going to have a very skittish spider that could kick some hair. And the best end of it, you're going to have this big gentle giant that just sits there. And I have a couple of those. And finally, to end off, let's talk about a couple of the individual species that I've raised up. Now, Theraphosa sturmi, as I told you, the first one I ever got was a male that I didn't know was male at the time. It was an unsexed, quote-unquote, juvenile young adult, and it molted out male, which was fine. That one lived quite a while after its molt. Big, beefy animal. You could hear that thing climbing around its enclosure. It was crazy. But a couple notes on how to differentiate them. It's slings. Know that the Theraphosa sturmi, the front four legs have pink toes. That's how you can tell the slings. And I've had people show me, hey, I got an apophysis. And I'm like, nope, that's a sturmi, because there's only four pink toes. The apophysis, and one of the reasons why it's called the pink toe, pink toe Goliath or pink foot Goliath bird eater, is because all of the toes have that pink and they keep them for quite a while. And the Theraphosa Blondii, no pink toes. So that's one easy way to tell them apart as their slings and know if what you got is a species you ordered, because I've had people go, I think this one's the wrong species, and most times it's right. But the Theraphosa Sturmii, the other way as adults, now there's other little subtle things like thickness of femurs and stuff of that nature, but the ones that usually stand out, the quickest way to determine an adult Sturmii from a Blondii, and these guys used to get confused for each other all the time. Back in the day, Blondies were super difficult to get. They were considered the true Goliath bird eaters, even though there's a lot of discussion that maybe Sturmii get actually heavier. Who knows? The Sturmii was considered to be like the poor man's Goliath bird eater. Like you'd say, oh, I have a Goliath bird eater. What kind of Sturmii? Oh, that's not the real one. They're just as big. But the big difference is the Sturmii have those smooth knees. They don't have any of the hairs on the patellas. The T. Blondii, on the other hand, have those hairs all the way up. And once you see it and compare them, it's pretty obvious. Remember back in the day, somebody coming on a video, I thought I had a Blondii and ended up being a Sturmii. And like, how do you know? And they're like, the hair's on the knees. I'm like, what are you talking about? And when I finally got them and was able to compare them, I was like, yeah, it's blatantly obvious. So that's something to know as far as telling the adults apart. But my Sturmii's, my first two that I raised, well, the first one that was a male was already almost full grown when I got it. But the other two reached 5 inches in their first year. They were great eaters. They did some burrowing. I'm now raising a young adult female. She's doing great. She's got a burrow, a little crazy. I got her 2 years ago as about an inch and 3/4 inch sling. And in her last molt, she was right around 7 inches or so. So she's getting quite big. With the other two that I raised, the brother and sister, the male was around 9 inches, I think, when he died, very gangly 9 inches. The female was around 9.5 inches. That was one that died prematurely. Not sure what happened. I blame myself for it. It still kills me. It still bugs me. I loved that female, but new one's doing great. The Blondies have all done great, so maybe it was just one of those things, but it still bothers me. Now, the Theraphosa Blondii, I picked up 2 slings from Fear Not Tarantulas in April of 2016. They reached closer to 5 or 6 inches the first year. They grew a little bit more quickly, but keep in mind, at that point, I was starting to add supplemental heat to the tarantula room, so that was probably the reason why. So they grew a little more quickly, not over the top, but a little more quickly. These two have been a dream to raise up. I was freaking out when I got the Blondii because all I'd read at that point is Blondies were so difficult to keep, and again, I have my suspicions that these species that have been raised and bred in captivity for a while, a couple generations, seem to do a little bit better as time goes on. Again, just a theory, but whatever the case, they've done very, very well. I've had no problems with them. As I mentioned before, I burrowed a bit as slings, burrowed a bit as juveniles, and now my big female burrows has a burrow that she actively goes to if things get a little sketchy outside, like if I go to pick up her enclosure, she'll sometimes bolt in it. But very visible spiders, very laid back, never any threat postures, never any hairs kicked out at me. They're just wonderful, wonderful spiders and gigantic. The last time my big female, well, one of the other ones actually bigger, but the last time this other female molted, the one that's in the new enclosure, it was 8.7, the molt was 8.75 inches after it dried up, or 22.22 centimeters. So I'm guessing she's over the 9-inch mark with the next molt. I'm guessing we'll be pushing 10. We'll have to see how it goes. And then Theraphosa apophysis, or the pinkfoot Goliath bird eater, I got my 2 slings in April of 2020. They were about 1.5 to 1.75 inches, or 3.81 to 4.45 centimeters. They were very, very leggy. Both of them, these guys reached about 3 to 4 inches in their first year, 7.62 to 10.16 centimeters. So little, overall, they've been more slow growing than the Sturmii or Blondii. Still put on a lot of, they're still fast growing compared to most spiders, but a little more slow growing. Now, these guys are much more leggy than the other ones, as I mentioned before, a little more lithe, thin, not as beefy. Adults are very leggy. Males are purple, which is, for people to say they're just big brown spiders, you obviously haven't seen a picture of a 10 or 11 inch purple spider. They are absolutely stunning. So I would not be upset if one of these turns out to be a male. And again, they go through, everybody says they're big brown spiders. They go through phases where they almost have pink on them, and those pink toes stay for a while. So they're pretty, pretty spiders. But mine, temperament wise, these have been the slower growing out of the three species and the more skittish of the three species. They were skittish as babies. They were skittish as juveniles. They're still a bit skittish as adults. Although, as I said, my female that's in the bigger enclosure just goes and hides anytime. I'm trying to catch her out and about. It's been very difficult because anytime I touch that enclosure, she goes right to her burrow. But I did get some footage of her recently where I was, you know, came up at night and she was out and about, but both been more skittish than the other two species. But overall, amazing spiders, and we'll see, because they're still kind of in that juvenile phase. These guys, again, can reach supposedly 10 to 12 inches, so if they're like the other two species, as they get to that size and put on more size, they may calm down a bit. I will obviously keep folks updated as they continue to grow. So that is my overview of Theraphosa species. Hopefully for folks that are interested, I gave you some stuff there, some tips and tricks. And again, I didn't go back for some of them and explain every type. I've used probably 10 different types of enclosures for these guys over the course of the years, just meaning different things I was using at the time and then I no longer use. So this is the most current stuff that I use. One thing I may change if I raise them up again is we talked about the Sterilite one, the one that's about 17 inches or so by 12 by 11, whatever it is. That one, I may go for a deeper one next time to give more room to burrow. That's the only drawback of those. It works great until they get to be around 6 or 7 inches. Then they're really too big to have much room to burrow. So I may switch into something that's the same overall floor space, but they make Sterilite ones like that. They're a little bit taller. That might be more appropriate to give it room to burrow. So that's something I might switch moving ahead for my juveniles. But besides that, that's about it. This is as current as I get as far as the care with these. Again, if they continue to grow, if they reach that mythological 10 to 11 to even 12 inch mark, will they all get larger enclosures? Yes, they will. But right now, what I have them in has been working great. If you put them in something bigger, I would just advise you, if it's really big, make sure you have burrows on both sides so they can pick. Make sure you have those water dishes. Make sure there's enough substrate in there to prevent them from possibly crawling up the side of the enclosure and falling. But awesome species. I absolutely love them. As I mentioned in the beginning, I will always have three of these, you know, all three species in my care. And I'm really excited about doing the video, the genus review on them, because it's been something I've wanted to do since I got the Apophysis. And again, I jumped the gun back in the day and went, all right, we're going to review these guys, even though I've only kept these guys for a bit. Well, here's the updated version with the Apophysis and some more information. So that will do it for this one. If you keep these species, please feel free to chime in what you're doing, what you're seeing. I love hearing other people's way of keeping them. Those comments, whether I read them or whether they're on Spotify or the website, other people can see them, see what you're doing. Who are the other Theraphosa aficionados out there? What do you love about them? Come in, please feel free to chime in. As far as YouTube, I just put up a video featuring some Afanopelmas that I had to rehouse because they're still not growing. I rehouse these guys more than probably any of my other spiders. And it's more because they just sit in these enclosures for years and I decide I just want to switch things up. So I did move. It was Moderatum, Bicoloratum, and my smaller Chalcodas all got moved into new enclosures. So if you want to check that, I know people love Afanopelma. We moved those and did some talking about the care of those. That should do it for this one. As always, you can find me on thomasbigspiders.com. You can find me on Thomas Big Spiders, the podcast. Guys, stay safe, have a good one, and we'll catch you all next time.